You're listening to Let's Talk Macro.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Let's Talk Macro, the podcast on macroeconomics by IDFC Mutual Fund, where we bring you interesting, important and topical macroeconomic conversations, both global and domestic. This includes, you know, relevant economic events, data, concepts and the inferences and implications that all of these dialogues have on us, or these major events have on us. I'm Ahalya on today's podcast. So joining us right now is Srijit Balasubramanian, economist in the fixed income fund management team at IDFC Mutual Fund. He has an experience of close to 13 years in macroeconomic research and handles all the in-house domestic and global economic research for us as well. And you've probably heard his voice on Let's Talk Macro in the past few episodes. Now, on today's podcast, we're going to be discussing how monetary policy response in the US to the COVID pandemic differed from that to the 2008 global financial crisis, or the GFC as we're going to refer to it through this conversation. We're going to look at the various measures taken by the Fed in response to the two crises, the difference in economic and monetary policy contexts, and how policy normalization has also been different. Some very interesting themes. Welcome to the show, Srijit. How are you doing?
Hi, thank you. It's good to be on the third episode of Let's Talk Macro.
Yes, absolutely. And a very interesting conversation today, Srijit. I think why don't we start, you know, by understanding the context, really, some two very different events, but with similar outcomes, right, on our economy. So central banks were actually quick to respond to the pandemic in early 2020 when it hit and continued with their support for quite a while as well. Now, if you look at the US, right, what was the primary difference between the Fed's response to the pandemic and to the GFC? Very open-ended question, but take it away for us.
So the Fed's primary tool is the Fed's, you know, the Fed funds target rate. So it's policy rate, which the, you know, the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, decides. So if you remember, the FOMC had actually cut its policy rate by around, you know, 150 basis points in March 2020, you know, when the pandemic started. But more importantly, we have to actually look at the policy stance and the level of rates before the two crises. It sort of, you know, reflect the economic context going into each of these two crises. Now, 2002 to 2003, which is before the GFC, globally, we had a very strong trade and economic growth period. And even the US is experiencing some inflationary pressures back. So from 2004 to 2006, the Fed had actually raised rates by, you know, over 400 basis points, I think 425 basis points to be exact. And it held it there till end of August 2007. So when the GFC hit, it could actually cut rates in response to the crisis by a very steep, you know, 500 basis points in over a year. So if you compare that to the eve of the pandemic, where policy rates were only 150 basis points above zero. So there's this big difference in gap.
Right.
So this is because after GFC, the Fed continued to hold rates low for several years. And, you know, it started normalizing or actually raising rates only from end 2015. So that is like a good 7 years after the GFC hit. Even then, it had actually cut rates in 2019 as the economy was, you know, benefiting from an extended expansion without any real inflationary concerns. So the space available to cut was quite different in each of these two crises. But so was the economic context in terms of, you know, in the inflation and labor markets.
That's really interesting. Thank you for opening up the conversation with that insight. I also want to draw everyone's attention to a really interesting phenomenon, right? Quantitative easing, or the QE. We've heard a lot about that and how the Fed undertook that for many years after the GFC, right? Was that also different this time in terms of their response? And where exactly are we with this whole QE thing?
So QE is nothing but, you know, the purchase of securities, typically longer-term government bonds or even, you know, mortgage-backed securities or MBS of government-sponsored entities in case of the US, which is to increase money supply in the economy, or in other words, you know, increase the reserves that banks hold at the Fed. Now, this obviously also increases the central bank's balance sheet size. Now, after the GFC, we had multiple rounds of QE across years, you know, as the euro area also witnessed economic turmoil, if you remember. Now, the so-called taper tantrum episode, when the Fed said it could actually just consider tapering its asset purchases. That is, you know, still buy assets, but buy a lesser amount. And some of the emerging markets, including India, witnessed capital outflows then. This was only in September 2013, if you remember. So, which is like, and again, you know, 5 years after the GFC hit. So, QE was actually quite spread out, with the initial response being in, you know, late 2008. But then across to 2009 to 2013, this continued. Contrary to that, QE just after the onset of the pandemic was much heavier and quicker. So during February to May 2020, which is, you know, during the initial phase of the pandemic, the Fed's balance sheet size actually increased by close to $3 trillion. which actually compares to just $1.3 trillion in late 2008. So that's almost like, you know, close to three times. So even if you look at it, you know, in terms of percentage of GDP or, you know, whatever it is to adjust for the size of the economy, QE still, you know, is much heavier and was much heavier and quicker in 2020, that is. So, and even after that, the Fed continued to increase its balance sheet size till 2022, yeah, last year, before it actually started tapering its asset purchases. So it's not actually much below the peak balance sheet size yet. So in fact, if you look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet alongside, you know, that of the European Central Bank, the ECB, or the Bank of Japan, the BOJ, or even the RBI for that matter, if you look at it, you know, if you sort of start just before the pandemic and then you see the trajectory thereafter, you can actually clearly see how big the spike is for the Fed in terms of the balance sheet size versus, you know, the other countries. And it's continuation at a higher level. You know, although admittedly, some part of it is due to, you know, the strength of the dollar. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you'll have currency depreciation for other countries and their balance sheet sizes would look a little smaller. But then despite that fact, you can actually appreciate the fact that, you know, the Fed's balance sheet expansion has been much larger. So, in fact, if you look at the RBA's balance sheet, it actually peaked in October 2021, which is, you know, late last year, the year before that, in fact, as it started deploying its FX reserves. So this is the difference in where we stand today in terms of balance sheet size. But another thing that we also need to pay attention to is the composition of the change in balance sheet. So, you know, for example, if you look at the asset side of the Fed's balance sheet, back in GFC, you know, you had a lot of purchases of mortgage-backed securities like we just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So that was much higher because that is the nature of the crisis then, because the crisis was then linked to the housing sector. And what we had now was a pandemic. So the share of the MBS purchases was much lower. Similarly, the Fed started using the reverse repo facility from 2014 only, where it actually sells securities with an agreement to repurchase and pays interest to counterparties. So, but that happened only from 2014. So you wouldn't see that as a major part on the liabilities, and during the GFC, but that's a much bigger number now. So the liabilities side would look very different for that instance. So these are some of the examples, you know, and the impact of what the QE that you can see on the Fed's balance sheet actually.
Okay. All right. And good that you bring up the RBI, actually, because I did want to pivot the conversation towards looking at comparing at least two different contexts. You know, we saw that the RBI introduced several other measures, right, during the pandemic, apart from interest rate changes and asset purchases. And I don't know if I'm right in assuming this, but I'm sure the Fed might have done something similar too. You know, what were those measures that they sort of introduced? And were they very different from the facilities that they rolled out in response to the GFC?
Yeah, so you're right. So the various facilities were rolled out by the Fed in 2020, and some of them were in fact new. But before that, actually, if you look at it, it established some standard off-the-shelf facilities, like, you know, like FX swap lines with central banks, reduction in the primary credit rate, which is the rate at which Fed lends to generally sound depository institutions. And this is also linked to the Fed funds rate. So these were used during GFC also. But apart from these two things the Fed did in 2020, where one, it established a temporary foreign international monetary authorities repo facility for, you know, foreign central banks. And it also temporarily changed the supplementary leverage ratio rule, which is nothing but to reduce the tier one capital that banks are required to maintain for about a year. But apart from these measures, there are actually nine special facilities initiated by the Fed in response to COVID. And actually, out of this, five are new and not there during the GFC. So just to give an example, one of the five new facilities was a Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility, so which was in place actually, you know, from April 2020, and it was there for more than a year. This program, if you look at it, so there's this Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, by the Small Business Administration in the US, which actually provided loans to small businesses so that they can keep their workers on payroll during the pandemic. The Fed's facility in turn supplied liquidity to participating financial institutions through term financing backed by these PPP loans to small businesses. This is one sort of a facility. Another example that I can give you is the Main Street Lending Program, which actually supported lending to eligible small and medium-sized businesses with deferral of principal and interest payments. Now, even the facilities that were not new, apart from these five, were actually quite effective. Some of these were actually there, like I said, during the GFC also. For example, the Money Market Mutual Fund Liquidity Facility, which assisted money market funds in meeting demands for redemptions by households and investors. And even something like the primary dealer credit facility, which allowed primary dealers to support smooth market functioning, right? And just to ensure the availability of credit. So all these credit facilities which actually kicked in were very timely, and some of them were well utilized also, and that really helped. But also you have to look at what other measures apart from the credit facilities, particularly in 2008, were, because the nature of the crisis was quite different. Now in GFC, we had a financial crisis which actually originated from the housing sector. Mm-hmm. So the Fed had to authorize an acquisition of financial institutions, and even lending to some by regional Feds.
Right.
It had something called an operational twist, which is quite famous. It was actually done in 2011, mm-hmm. where it actually bought long-term treasury securities and simultaneously sold short-term ones. As mm-hmm. like I said before, the things are also complicated by the euro crisis after GFC. So in fact, post-GFC period saw the rise of forward guidance as a major tool, which is a big thing even now. So in short, all the facilities and measures the Fed rolled out in response to the pandemic, some of them are definitely new, but all of them are quite important.
Nice. Okay. Also great that you sort of bring up the difference, right, between context of the GFC and how it's rooted in the housing sector and the pandemic. I think that's important for us to remember because, when we look at the pandemic being this major economic event, it was followed by many other economic events as we've seen over the past 2 years, right? One of the biggest things is the rising inflation all over the world that people are experiencing. And we're currently in the phase where many central banks around the world are withdrawing their policy accommodations, right, that they actually provided during the pandemic, and going beyond that, like the Fed, for example, is doing now to fight very high inflation. Withdrawal of monetary policy support is equally as important as providing it, it would seem. How different is that at this time?
You see, right. So normalization is a very important aspect, and again, different this time, given the different context. After GFC, we had a slow exit phase, where initially liquidity and credit facilities were allowed to expire. And then forward guidance was tweaked, asset purchases tapered only from early 2014, policy rates were hiked only from December 2015, and Fed's balance sheet normalization, in fact, started only in 2017. And even that was sort of reversed, and rates were, like I said before, cut again in 2019. So it took a really long time. And it was, like I said, a very slow exit, as inflation was actually undershooting the Fed's 2% target. And then around 2019, if you remember, the economy was clearly benefiting from an extended expansion. So in the US, unemployment rate was low, not just at the headline level, but even across lower income groups and for various ethnic groups. The Fed, in fact, updated its monetary policy strategy and adopted the average inflation targeting framework, which is, where it actually decided that it will allow inflation to overshoot its target for a while so that the 2% target is achieved on average over time. So it's not like, it will immediately hike rates when the inflation goes above 2%. It will let it be there for a while so that it averages 2% over a period of time. In fact, it also made assessment of economy's maximum employment more broad-based and not just based on a single number. So all this effectively, like I said, meant the Fed would actually tolerate inflation even if it is a little above 2% and not raise policy rates immediately when it sees inflation go beyond that. But then, obviously, COVID happened. And more importantly, the outsized fiscal response that we saw in the US to COVID. So what happened during COVID was that we had an unprecedented situation of global supply bottlenecks, but also very large direct fiscal stimulus in the US. Unlike in India, for example, where the stimulus was much more nuanced. And a large part of this direct cash payments and unemployment insurance really pushed up the excess savings pool of households. So this actually pushed goods inflation much higher, which is what you see rotating now into services and rents. And the demand-supply balance in the labor market was completely off. Job openings spiked and wage growth picked up beyond their normal rates. So hence, the Fed, after initially thinking the high inflation episode would be transitory, it actually changed its narrative in 2021, late 2021, around November, and started raising rates and tapering its asset purchases from 2022, last year that is. So far, if you see, the Fed has raised policy rates by 425 basis points. It plans to raise it further this year and potentially keep it at that peak rate, even if growth slows down, until they actually see signs of sustained decline in inflation. But again, if you see recently, the headline inflation prints have started to come off, but core inflation has been stickier. And, we have to look at wage growth, which continues to sort of stay high as well. Mm-hmm. So this time, it's not just a withdrawal of accommodation, but further tightening, and that too much faster when many other central banks are also doing the same. So if you actually compare it to the GFC, in terms of normalization, we are hiking much more. It's been faster. The magnitude is also higher. So the tools are quite similar, but the way the Fed has used it is also different because the response to the crisis, particularly fiscal, was much different this time.
All right. I think this gives us a pretty good picture of how contextual macroeconomics is as well, and how important it is to consider context throughout all of these dialogues. And from today's conversation, I think it's clear that, you know, the monetary policy response in the U.S. to the pandemic, whether it was in the case of rate cuts or QE or rolling out credit facilities, were all different from that during the GFC. And so is policy normalization and fight against high inflation. But it's working. Hopefully, for us all. Really hope, everyone, that this podcast helped you understand the impact of the monetary policy measures taken in the US, what the Fed is doing, what it's doing now, and what it holds for the near future as well. That's all from Srijith and I on today's edition of Let's Talk Macro. I'm sure we'll be back with another interesting conversation on the series. In the meantime, stay caught up with all that's happening around us. And yeah, stay safe.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.